Roll down tide.
From the Clark Ford Studio in Oxford, Mississippi, this is the Beer Garden presented by Oxford Crystal.
I'd like to hear a little bit more conviction in your take, though. There was a lot of maybes, a lot of what ifs, a lot of questions. You need to just get on here. You need to fire and put me in a position where I have to tell you that you're wrong.
And now, here's your host, Neil McCready.
Nice. Nice.
Welcome into another edition of the Oxford Crystal Beer Garden. I'm your host, Neil McCready. Today on the show, Adam Rubin, who is the assistant AD at the New York Institute of Technology, but that's not really what we talked to him about. He spent 15 years as the Mets beat writer, first for the New York Daily News and then for ESPN 1000, ESPN New York, I should say, there in New York. Still does some Mets coverage for Sportsnet New York. But we'll talk to him about the first victim of ESPN's cord cutting. He was already kind of looking to check out of ESPN and check out of journalism as a whole, really. But we talk about a lot of things, journalism, baseball, a number of things, talk about the Mets some as well. So we'll get to that in a minute. First, let me tell you about the Oxford Crystal. It's on Highway 6 West in Oxford, just next to the Oxford Exxon. Right now, you can get the Mix 5 for $5. That includes the Country Fried Steak Crystal and the Country Fried Chicken Crystal. As always, the bigger breakfast combo with the fresh cracked eggs, French toast sticks. And then it's getting hot outside, 90, 91 degrees already. So you can go get the frozen and fabulous Kool-Aid slushies, green apple, grape. And also, if you'd rather get something a little caffeinated, you can get the caramel mocha frost, all of that at Crystal. Highway 6 West in Oxford, just next to the Oxford Exxon. We're coming to you from the Clark Ford Studios. Clark Ford is in Amory, Mississippi. It's just off Highway 25, 662-257-1900. Call that number. Ask for Corey Clark. Tell Corey what new Ford you're looking for. He'll send you a quote within 15 minutes in business hours. And then you can have a decision to make. You can take that quote and you can shop it all over, that's certainly your prerogative, or you can let Corey and the people at Clark Ford do for you what they've done for listeners of this podcast from Missouri to Biloxi, from Shreveport into Georgia, and that's take the hassle out of the everyday car buying experience. And then at the end of your purchase, right about the time you're finalizing your deal, tell Corey you heard about the podcast here on the Beer Garden, you heard about it on the Oxford Exxon podcast. Either way, $500 off the bottom line on your deal at Clark Ford in Amory, 662-257-1900. The podcast also brought to you in part by Community Mortgage. It's located in Oxford, Memphis, DeSoto County, and Chattanooga. 30 years old this year, one of the oldest mortgage companies in the Southeast. All the underwriting and the processing is done in Memphis, so you're getting local underwriting that understands your market. Community Mortgage is also the leader in condo financing in the Oxford market. Ask Jason Lowe about the Community Mortgage float down option, which allows you to lock in the current rate, but if rates go down before you close, you can get the lower rate. Give him a call, 662-234-2704, or send him an email. It's jlowe, that's J-L-O-W-E, at communitymtg.com. Now let's go to Adam Rubin of SNY in New York, and the former Mets beat writer for ESPN New York. Adam, long time no talk. It's great to catch up with you. You probably don't know this about me. When you were at the Birmingham News for a little while, I was at some of the weekly papers in Birmingham, and then I was at the Birmingham Post-Herald, and we crossed paths some, but always just admired your work. And then you landed the job in New York. And at the time, and we'll get into this in a minute, it shows you how much, I guess, my field and your former field sort of still field has changed. You landed that job in New York, and I thought, he's arrived. I mean, he has made it. He has made it to the big time, and in many ways you had. And then the field just changed almost overnight over those 10 years or so. Anyway, welcome into the show, and thanks for spending some time.
My pleasure. It's great to catch up.
So you spent I guess for our listeners, for background, you were in Birmingham for several years. I think you went to Shreveport for a year, and then you came back, and you had a sort of a multitude of assignments in Birmingham. You covered UAB, you covered the Birmingham Barons, the Birmingham Bulls. We'll talk about them in a little bit as well. You did some SEC stuff. You were sort of a jack of all trades, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, no, I had a ton of fun in Birmingham. It was the best Ashley newspaper experience I ever had. Some of the highlights. I missed Michael Jordan, who was there in 94. I came back after an internship in 95, so I missed Michael Jordan with the Barons, but had a great experience there. So many of those guys graduated to the White Sox, from Joe Creedy to Aaron Rowan to Mark Burley. Had a great time covering the Bulls, the minor league hockey team. UAB sent some players, including Brian Thomas, to the Jets from the era I was there. And then I caught the, unfortunately, not the high point of Alabama athletics. My last year there, 2000, was, I think Alabama was preseason number 3, went out to UCLA, got pretty well stomped the first game, and that was Mike DuBose's last year. I think they went 3-8 that year.
Yeah, I remember those days well. I was covering Auburn, and you're right, that Alabama team was supposed to be great, and it was sort of like the Auburn team of, was it, I guess, 2000, 2001, 2002, when they were supposed to be so great, and they started off the exact same way. They went out there, or USC came to them and popped them, and their season fell apart. So you, when you took the job, I know you're, I think you're a native New Yorker, right?
Yeah, I grew up on Long Island, so it was nice to come home when I got the job in New York. But honestly, my experience in Birmingham was absolutely fabulous.
When you get the job in New York, you're I don't think you were covering the Mets right away. You were doing a number of things, and then they put you on the Mets beat. And if I read this correctly, I read some stuff just kind of getting ready for this, where you thought, you know, it's going to be a year or two, and then I'm going to do some different things. Did you ever think, with that first day that you went to New York, and then the first day you started on the Mets beat, that would be a 15-year gig?
No, literally, the sports editor at the time, Leon Carter, told me, just do it for 2 years. You'd think that everyone on a staff wants to cover a Major League Baseball team, but the fact is that when I was covering the team, I was on the road 160 days a year. You'd go down to Florida for spring training, which sounds great, except you'd leave maybe home February 10th, and if the team started the season on the road, the regular season, you wouldn't get home until, say, like April 10th, so you'd literally be away from home for 2 straight months. So people with families on the staff, really, that wasn't very appealing to them. And the way the job has evolved with technology has become even more nonstop now. So they looked around the staff, and I was single, and they said, you know what, you're going to be the beat guy for the Mets. So just do it a couple of years, we'll rotate you off. But I really, really enjoyed the experience and thrived. And actually, the gentleman I mentioned, Leon Carter, he got hired by ESPN, and I followed him there. So I ended up covering the Mets between the New York Daily News and ESPN for 15 years between the two outlets. And I'm still dabbling a little bit with it, but we're mostly out of it now.
When you were in Birmingham, obviously you competed against Huntsville, and you competed against Mobile and the AJC and stuff. What was the New York, just the competition among the newspapers like back in, you're back there covering the heyday of newspapers, really?
Yeah, no, I was literally, when I first started, I would basically kind of drop in helping out each of the beat writers. So I drop in on a Yankee game, I drop in on a Met game, Jets, Giants, Rangers, Knicks. And literally, I was in awe listening to how the questions were phrased. Because in Birmingham, pretty conservative newspaper, we were very respectful with the way we asked questions and kind of danced around things a little bit. These guys were blunt and in your face. It was a eye-opening experience. So I was a little bit in shock, but it was such a it actually, you know, I thought it was going to be kind of, you hear like the rumor, like what people talk about New York tabloids and all that, but there was a lot of really, really, really good work done at the New York papers in that era. Things have changed with the economics of newspapers, and a lot of the guys who wrote the longer features and stuff like that have gotten laid off. But at the time, it was the Daily News, at least, was a top-notch newspaper, one of the best newspapers in the country.
When you made the move to ESPN, I know that was in large part because of the editor that you'd had at the Daily News who went to ESPN. You referenced him a minute ago. Were you at that time, was it more about that, or was it were you starting to become alarmed about the move from print to digital?
Well, it's funny because it seemed like newspapers at the time were falling apart. Obviously, the internet's eroded their revenue. We saw in Birmingham, there were two newspapers in Birmingham, the Post Herald and the Birmingham News when I was there, and you were there. And now there's one paper coming out, what, three times a week? So certainly the digital side and TV side seem much safer. It's funny now that, well, not funny, but the same realities that were hitting the newspaper industry 10 years ago are now hitting TV networks just as hard, if not harder. ESPN in the last couple of weeks laid off 100 on-air talent people, and part of that is because of cord cutting and the same things, reasons why people stop buying print editions of newspapers. People are not buying cable as much anymore. ESPN 5 years ago, I read, had 100 million subscribers. Now they're down to 87 million, and 87 million is still an absolutely huge number. But if you lose 13 million subscribers and each person's cable bill, $7 each month is going towards, of that bill is going towards ESPN, that's almost $100 million a month in lost revenue from 5-6 years ago that they don't have anymore. So you can imagine the economies of that, especially when the rights fees for MLB and NFL and all those leagues are 5, 10, 15 years out and they've committed $1 billion to each of those.
You weren't laid off by ESPN. Well, I guess in a way you were. You were ready to move on, but you would have been probably one of the 100+ people that got laid off. You turns out your story when you told it and you gave a quote about the one of the editors at ESPN said they wanted to get away from quote thorough beat coverage. A lot of people probably saw that quote and said, "Uh oh." I mean, what was your impression when, because you were always and have always been a guy that you covered your beat in such detail, with such accuracy, with so much objectivity. And I mean, I'm not a Mets fan, but I would follow your stuff on Twitter just to keep up with the Mets. And I didn't have to follow anybody else. It was so thorough. I always looked at that and thought that's the way to do it. And yet they're sitting there telling you at the time, hey, we're going to move in a different direction and completely away from the way that you did your job for 15 years.
Yeah, I mean, irrespective of the layoffs, ESPN's digital traffic was slipping a little bit in recent years. And they brought in a new baseball editor who came from ESPN the magazine. And her idea was to be more, not a one-stop shop with every nugget of information, but basically write features that are appealing nationwide. So even though you're assigned to a specific team, your goal is to get a national audience for your articles. And I've always thought it's a lot easier to just have the same customers coming back day after day or minute after minute to get new morsels of information than it is to try to cast a huge net and try to appeal to everybody with every story. So I was much more into just churning out information repeatedly throughout the day and having a large group of Met fans just come back 10, 15 times a day to read what was new. But their approach was different. And then obviously they had to layoffs too. So now they don't even have the bodies to cover it the way I wanted to cover it.
You were talking about before we got started, and I thought it was really interesting when you first got started. I mean, yeah, you were on a demanding beat covering the Mets, but there was an end moment. I mean, there was a final deadline when, okay, for lack of a better term, you're off the floor. It's over. I can remember that, you know, covering Auburn and Mobile, you know, whether it was 11:30 or midnight or 12:30, there was a moment when the paper had to go to the press and you were done. You were done, and you would pick back up the next day, and if you'd gotten beat on a story, you would advance that story. If you had broken a story, you'd wait and kind of see the way other people moved it, and then you'd go from there. When everything got so digital, when you're at ESPN New York and you're covering the Mets, and just, I guess for the listeners, how did the job change? How did the job demands change on you, and how were you able, given the fact that you're, like you were, I think you're about to say, you were on 24 hours a day, how are you able to kind of have a life?
Well, I mean, if you cover baseball and you cover it the right way these days, you really don't have a life because you have to be on 24 hours a day. There's people nationally like John Heyman and Ken Rosenthal. I don't know how they have the stamina to do it because they're covering 30 teams and they're just basically churning out information, not just at the trade deadline, but nonstop throughout the year. You mentioned about newspapers. When the final product was the newspaper. That was the primary product, whatever the deadline was for the newspaper, whether it was midnight or New York Daily News. Actually, the last deadline was 2 a.m. But when that 2 a.m. deadline hit, you were done and there's nothing you could do. And you just held your breath to see what the New York Post had on its front cover in the morning and what you had on your front cover in the morning. If you got beat, you got beat. It stunk, but you had 24 hours to come back and do better the next day. Now, I mean, I could tell you stories where I've broken portions of a story and yet you still didn't get the whole story because you have to keep churning out information throughout the day. I'll give you an example. When the Mets acquired Addison Reed, the reliever from the Diamondbacks a couple years ago, I got tipped off in the mid-afternoon that the Mets were about to make a trade. So you put out on Twitter that the Mets are about to make a trade, more details to come, and then you're basically alerting all your competitors, hey, look out for a story too. Then they start looking out for the story too. So you're putting all your cards on the table. But then I got the Mets and the Diamondbacks are close to a trade. So I tweeted that out or put it on the website, but you're not done there. Then you have to find out what piece the Mets are getting. So you report that the Mets are getting Addison Reed an hour later, you're leaning on sources. And so you break that portion of it. But then someone else, Bob Nightingale from USA Today, broke who the Mets were sending back the other way. And I don't know if he would even been alerted to it had I not mentioned in the first place that a trade was about to happen and the piece is going one way. So it's really nonstop throughout the day now. And there's people with families who on their days off, they just turn off their phone and stuff like that. But I'm not really wired that way. So it wasn't really a healthy profession because you want to break every little piece of minutia. I mean, for instance, even like the day we're talking today with the Mets, they sign just a kind of a minor league pitcher to supplement their pitching staff. So you want to break that. They put Esdrubal Cabrera on the DL. So you want to break that. You want to break who they're calling up. Heck, I wanted to even break what the lineup was for the day. So it's just nonstop stuff throughout the day that just keeps coming at you. And if you're good, you just keep churning that information out, but it's exhausting.
How did your relationship with players change from even your early days covering the Birmingham Barons, the AA affiliate for the White Sox, to the way it was? Maybe you covered a World Series. You covered a team that went to the World Series before losing to Kansas City. How did it over those 2 decades? How did the media relationship with the players in the locker room in the clubhouse change?
Well, one of the reasons why I say I enjoyed Birmingham so much is because the people I covered for the most part were appreciative of the coverage. When you're covering minor league sports, one, you're telling stories that haven't been told or haven't been told that much. Sure, they were either college stars or high school stars, but for a bigger audience, the story hasn't been told yet, and they're receptive to telling their story. So that's a lot of fun for me. I enjoyed covering preps in Birmingham more than maybe anything at all, because those were stories you were basically getting told for the first time. But to answer your question, I mean, even in the 15 years covering the Mets, the relationship with the players dramatically changed. And I think it has a lot to do with the players who grew up in the social media era. I can almost draw a line at maybe like players age 30 and older versus age 30 and under. And the players that are 30 and older, I have so much better relationships with because they're engaging. They want to talk. They understand the mutual benefits of dealing with the media and being respectful, where the younger players, and maybe rightfully so, are so guarded these days, at least in the Met clubhouse and a lot of baseball clubhouses, because of social media. They can't go out anymore without everything being photographed and stuff. So they're a lot more skittish of dealing with reporters. So it hasn't been, I mean, that doesn't mean I don't have positive business relationships with most of those guys, but it's totally different now, where a lot of the guys are much more guarded because they grew up in an era of social media where anything they say or anything they do gets inflamed all over the place instantly.
You're still doing a little bit of stuff with the Mets, doing some stuff with SNY out of New York. This Mets team off to a really rough start. The pitching staff's kind of falling apart. Syndergaard's hurt. Matt Harvey's a mess. Are you surprised that this team has struggled the way that it has?
Well, the one thing that's absolutely startling, and yes, there have been injuries, but the Mets entered this week with the worst starting pitcher ERA in the majors. And if you would have told me that in spring training, even knowing at the time that Seth Lugo and Steven Matz were going to open the year on the DL, I would have been absolutely shocked. And Jacob deGrom has been very average. Matt Harvey is really, really struggled. You know, he's coming back from not just Tommy John surgery, but now thoracic outlet syndrome surgery, where they had to remove his top rib. So he's coming back from two surgeries, and he has been very underwhelming. Obviously, Noah Syndergaard now is on the DL with a lat strain. That's a whole different issue of how they allowed him to pitch with knowing there was an injury already in place that probably exacerbated things. But I mean, it's crazy. But when you tell me that if you would have told me on the flip side that Noah Syndergaard and Steven Matz and Seth Lugo from their rotation would be out, and you told me Yoenis Cespedes, the top hitter, and Travis d'Arnaud would be on the DL, big-time position players, and David Wright, for that matter, and we don't know if David Wright's ever going to come back, and then you told me the closer, Jeurys Familia, now is going to be out for the rest of the year, you know, I'd say, oh, maybe they would struggle, but the Nationals have certainly run away with the NL East. It's kind of, I actually tweeted the stat a couple days ago, it's kind of amazing that of the top five ERAs in Major League Baseball, highest ERAs in Major League Baseball, four are in the NL East, so the Nationals certainly have some pitching to feast on these days.
Yeah, the Nationals sort of doing what the Cubs did a year ago, just kind of running away in April and May and making it where they have so much of a cushion. I mean, they can afford – I mean, people don't even talk about it. The Cubs played, what, 500 baseball for 3 months last year, and it just didn't matter because they'd gotten off to such a massive start. With I'm going to get back to you in a second. Just one more Met thing. Matt Harvey, do you anticipate the Mets having to move him? Do they move him before the deadline?
If they're totally out of the race, it's not out of the realm of possibility. But if they're out of the race, it probably means because he hasn't been pitching exceptionally. And I don't want to know that they want to sell low on Matt Harvey. He's had some off the field drama too. The time that the Mets, when they were plotting Matt Harvey of the big class of Mets starting pitchers, Matt Harvey is the first one to hit free agency. His free agency after the 2018 season, and at one point, we thought, you know, he might get like a Clayton Kershaw type deal, $300 million. The Yankees and the Red Sox, and all the big markets will be bidding after him. Now, who knows what's going to happen with him? But when the Mets were plotting a few years ago, this past off season was when they wanted to trade him 2 years out from free agency. They thought that would maximize the amount they got for him, and they would get rid of him before he got really expensive and restock the farm system a little bit, and they have all this other starting pitching. But obviously, getting shut down last year and having to undergo surgery to remove that rib because he had a compressed nerve in his neck/shoulder area, sidetracked that, and now the performance is such that I don't know that it makes sense to trade him at the trading deadline because you're not going to be able to get that much.
So you're now the assistant athletic director for the New York Institute of Technology. I'm on your site right now, nyitbears.com. I mean, to say you're doing something different than covering the Mets is an understatement. How have you liked it?
I've really enjoyed it a lot. It's funny. You know what? When the Mets went to the World Series in 2015, I was chronicling someone else's moment. Now, contrast our athletics in Division II, for the most part, versus the Mets in Major League Baseball. Sure, it's more important covering a World Series or there's a bigger audience for that. But you know what? When our women's basketball team made the NCAA tournament, or our softball team or our lacrosse team made the NCAA tournament, I was a small part of that. And so it's fun being on this side of it where you're part of the success as opposed to just chronicling someone else's moments and being the adversary. It's fun knowing that, I probably shouldn't say this, but like our basketball team hasn't been announced yet. It's going to open next season at UCLA. It's fun knowing that stuff ahead of time and stuff like that. So that's just tremendously fun for me. And you know what? A lot of the job is the same. Teams are starting to create or have created their own content. You're in Mississippi, Ole Miss and Mississippi State, their websites have vibrant content, articles about their teams. So a lot of the stuff I did as an independent reporter or working for ESPN or working for the New York Daily News, that kind of stuff I do right now. It's just a little bit more of a positive tone, but I still write articles about the teams. I shoot photography. It's just a lot of fun to be around the college teams and promote them. And then I have to do some of the old functions too, like pitch stories to the newspapers and pitch stories to the TV networks. But a lot of it is just creating our own content, which is basically what I was doing already in my career.
You're right about the adversarial part. That's the part that I think the general public doesn't understand about sometimes the media covering teams. It almost gets adversarial is sometimes too strong of a word, but sometimes that's exactly the right word. And that can get draining from the reporting end of it, you know?
And certainly I had positive relationships with just about everyone I covered with the Mets. But the bottom line is that they have sensitive information they want to protect, and you're there trying to get that information. So right. In a sense, it's adversarial. Where here, I mean, there's we're a smaller university, so it's not like we're Alabama or Arkansas or anything like that, where people there's a million reporters going after the information. But here, it's more about making sure the information is presented properly, as opposed to trying to the uncertainty of not knowing what's next. Like, let's say if I'm covering the Mets now, are they going to make a trade for a starting pitcher because they have so many injuries? The unknown is very stressful as a reporter, because you're constantly trying to anticipate what they're going to do and break it. Whereas here, I could devote a lot more of my attention just creating good content.
Do you miss it at all?
Not really. I mean, you mentioned I'm still involved with SNY, which is Sportsnet New York. So just to kind of supplement my income, I do a little bit of reporting about the Mets on the side, but I thoroughly enjoy being on this side of it. And I mean, I hope I'm here for 20, 30 years, but if not, maybe I'm with a professional team being the media relations PR guy at some point. But I don't think I'll ever go back to full time on the reporting side. I really enjoy this side of it.
So you're also you're dabbling in professional sports ownership now. I mean, maybe if the deal at NYIT doesn't work out long term, maybe you're the next kind of Mark Cuban.
This is a little bit smaller scale than that. You know, we mentioned that I covered the Birmingham Bulls and the East Coast Hockey League in the 1990s, and just Art Clarkson, for those who've ever passed through Birmingham, was a big-time sports owner at the time. He owned the Bulls at the time. He owned the Barons, the AA baseball team at the time. Both sold them both for big profits late in the 1990s. And after that, the Bulls kind of folded about 5 years later. They moved to Atlantic City, New Jersey first, and then folded. Art had the idea to rekindle the Bulls and join the Southern Professional Hockey League. I invested in the team. I'm a very minority owner, but it's going to be fun. The team I covered is a little nostalgic in the 1990s. Is coming back this fall, going to be in a league with the Mississippi and some of the other former East Coast Hockey League cities. But I think it's actually a good investment too, because I know Art knows what he's doing. It's actually interesting, for those who know Birmingham, we're not going to play at the BJCC, the main arena in Birmingham. We're going to play down south in Pelham over the mountain. So they're adding seats to the arena there. So I think it's going to be about 4,500, 5,000 seats when all said and done down there, which is more than enough to make it viable. And it's going to be a fun experience. And I know a lot of the crowd that used to go to the Bulls games is from that over the mountain area, that Mountain Brook, Pelham, Hoover area. So I think the attendance is going to be really good. And I think people who kind of grew up with the Bulls are now adults and are going to be nostalgic. And actually, they just announced that Jamie Hicks is going to be the new first coach of the team. He was a player in the 1990s, the captain of the team in the 1990s. So it's a little nostalgic for me there, too.
That's cool. Do you get back there much, back to Birmingham?
You know what? When I was covering the Mets, obviously, I would pass through Atlanta 3-4 times a year, and I try to make a point of swing through Birmingham at least once a year. Unfortunately, in recent years, it's been for going away parties for Birmingham News folks, as that newspaper falls apart. But I certainly keep in touch with several people there. The sports writers, a lot of the sports writers from the big sports writers there have moved on, but I still keep in touch with all those guys. From Tom Ehrenberg was the sports editor there, to Doug Segrist, to Ron Ingram, who now I think is running the Alabama High School Athletic Association. Yeah. I keep in touch with all those guys and try to pass through there as much as I can, but definitely once a year. Now I have another, and Kurt Bloom from the Barons is still the announcer there.
Is that right?
Still try. Yeah. Wow. All these years later, CB is still there. So I try to pass through. I don't really know the UAB people anymore, where I covered the teams. I was kind of there in the Murray Bartow era and Watson Brown era of football and basketball there. So I don't really know the folks there anymore, but certainly try to pass through at least once a year. Now with the hockey team there, I'll hopefully have another reason to swing by.
You know, it's funny. You say some of those names and I kind of go down memory lane. I can remember Reuben Grant would always send me to Barons games. And at first I'd be like, oh man, I don't want to do that tonight. And then I always enjoyed those games. And then when I was in Mobile, I had a lot of Bay Bears duties. I'd go out to spring and stuff, and you think about it now, and you're like, yeah, those were the times that it was. You weren't covering, you know, Major League Baseball or whatever, but it was a lot of fun. You had lots of access, and I remember, like, you know, Jake Peavy and all those guys were coming up in the Padres organization, and I mean, Jake was a rock star in Mobile, of course, but you know, through him, I was able to get, you know, a lot of access to other guys. And you're right, that was a lot of fun. I guess last thing, you're there in New York, around New York, obviously. The Yankees have all this young talent. They're off to a great start. Is the city kind of have Yankee fever for the first time in a while?
Well, yeah, I'd say the pendulum has certainly swung back toward the Yankees. Met fans are pretty bitter these days, which is kind of funny considering they've made the playoffs two straight years. But Mets fans are very, very demanding, or I don't want to say spoiled, because they've enjoyed, or they've had huge stretches where the team hasn't been very good. But certainly with the young talent on the Yankees, you know, it's funny that the case study the last couple of years has been the Mets versus the Cubs. The Cubs built their team through young position players. The Mets built their team through young pitching. And it's proven so far that the building through the young position players is the way to go, that the Theo Epstein had it right, and the Mets, not that they had it wrong, but it's not as good a way to do it, because the pitching certainly breaks down, and the Mets are absolutely decimated right now, where it looked like they were to have a rotation. It's funny, the five guys in the rotation that are the most hype with the Mets, the young guys, are Noah Syndergaard, Matt Harvey, Jacob DeGrom, Steven Matz, and why am I drawing a blank on the other person?
Zach
I'm getting
Wheeler.
Old. Zach Wheeler, yeah. And but it's funny, they've never ever in the entire time I've been with the Mets pitched five consecutive games. They've never pitched a turn of the rotation. So it's kind of amazing. It just shows you how fragile the pitching is, and maybe it is better to just kind of buy some free agents on shorter term deals for the pitching and build through the Chris Bryants of the world, as opposed to the flip side where guys like Matt Harvey and Noah Syndergaard within a few years are gonna break down.
I wouldn't have believed it in October of 15, watching the Mets, I mean, just dominate the Cubs in that NLCS. The Cubs could do nothing with those arms. It was just one 95, 96, 97 mile an hour fastball after another. And they were, that was a swing and miss Cubs team too, but man, they were just dominated. And if you had told me that night of game four, if you had told me that the Mets wouldn't get back in the next 2-3 years, I would not have believed you.
Yeah, and I mean, they're buried themselves so much. I don't know if they're going to be able to climb out of it this year. Cespedes is supposed to be back in the next week, but it's certainly not looking good for the Mets right now. Syndergaard's going to be out possibly 3 months. Familia's out 3 months now. The closer, Matz and Lugo, two of the starting pitchers, are started rehab assignments now, or pitched extended spring training, and they're about to start rehab assignments, but they're still about 3 weeks away. So, I mean, this team very well could be buried by the time they finally kick things into gear. You know, last year in August, in mid-August, they were out in San Francisco. There were two games under 500 in mid-August, and they really turned it on. But there's a limit to how many times you could do that and be the kind of the closing horse. And they didn't catch the Nationals anyway. They just snuck into the wild card game. But this year, it's not looking very good. And it's probably Terry Collins' last year as the team's manager.
Well, Adam, it's been a lot of fun catching up with you. We'd love to do it again sometime. Good luck in the new gig. And again, thanks for the time. Good luck to your hockey club.
Thanks, Neil. It's been great catching up with you.
Thanks, Adam. Again, our thanks to Adam Rubin for joining us here on The Beer Garden. The Beer Garden also brought to you by LB's Meat Market, 2008 University Avenue in Oxford, 662-259-2999. We tell you all the time about their fresh cuts. They're the best in Oxford. Steaks, pork, chicken, it's all there at LB's. Also, the sausages are fantastic, and they've got some new ones. The Swayze sausage, listen to this. It's beer, bacon, cheese, and jalapenos. Tell me where that goes wrong. Beer, I'm good. Bacon on anything. Cheese and jalapenos in a sausage. Go in, tell them you want the Swayze sausage. Tell them you heard about it on the Beer Garden. They got some new summer sausages out. I tried them the other day. The Italian summer smoky bacon summer and the smoked black and blue, all fantastic. You'll love them. If you're like me, sometimes you get these really hot days and it's just too damn hot to cook. You don't want to cook. It's too hot. You don't want to grill. So you get some cheese, get some sausage, get some crackers, some beer or some wine. And if you want some beer, you can get it there at LB's as well. The beer fridge is right there on your left. Grab a six pack and tell Greg you heard about LB's on the Beer Garden, and that six-pack is $6 at LB's in Oxford, 662-259-2999. Finally, last but not least, the podcast brought to you by Strategic Partners in Media. They've been with us for a while now. SPM can help your business get through good or bad times, whether you're a Fortune 500 company, a mom and pop startup, or anything in between. You've got a crisis. You need a social media presence. You need an advertising campaign. The people at SPM can take care of you. They sort of refined their skills in the rough and tough political world. Let them take that expertise and bring it to your business to help you get through good or bad times. You need a social media campaign. You need a television advertising campaign. Whatever you might need, they can help you there at Strategic Partners in Media. For more information or to get in touch with them, email austin@strategicpartnersmedia.com. Again, that's austin@strategicpartnersmedia.com. We'll be back with you later this week with another Beer Garden. Not sure what we're going to do. I'm talking to Tony Jones, Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to do NBA, kind of a finals preview. That might be the first part of next week. Might touch base with our old pal Jeffrey Wright again. Working on some different things. The baseball season is approaching the quarter pole. Might talk about who's been disappointing, who's been a surprise. Look at the races one-fourth of the way through the major league season. So a lot of topics we might get to here in the next week or so. But we'll be back with another Beer Garden later in the week. Until then, take care.